Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Neil Barnard. Dr. Neil Barnard is a clinical researcher, a best-selling author, and one of America's leading advocates for health, nutrition, and higher standards in research. He's an adjunct associate professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences, and he's the founder and president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. Dr. Barnard is the author of more than 70 published research papers on nutrition and its impact on human health, and of 17 books, including the New York Times bestsellers Power Foods for the Brain and the 21-Day Weight Loss Kickstart. He's been a frequent guest on Dr. Oz, Ellen, and many other talk shows, and he's a leader in the medical community and with the general public. And now, Dr. Barnard, my dad and I love your work, and we're so grateful for this time with you. And now for this interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Neil, for being with us once again.
Well, thank you, John, and thanks to you as well, Ocean. It's grateful for the opportunity to talk with you again.
Well, I always find your insights and your knowledge and your love very, very empowering to listen to and receive and to share with our audience. And I want to start out by asking you about something that you've said that I think is important. I think it's true. And yet I think it's not nearly as well understood by the public as it should be. It's something that I think every man and every woman who loves a man would want to know. You said, Viagra is simply a pharmaceutical that opens arterial flow. In other words, it counteracts the effects of meat, cheese, and eggs. Neil, what I want to ask you is, have you had patients who switched to a plant-based diet and then were able to ditch their Viagra pills and reactivate their sex life?
We see it relatively commonly, actually. People come in to have their diabetes improve, or maybe they want to lose weight or get their cholesterol down. And we're dealing with pretty sick people. So we use a completely vegan diet. We throw the meat and the dairy out, keep oils really low, and something amazing happens to these people. Not only do they lose weight, their blood sugars improve, but quite frequently after several weeks, they notice that their sexual function starts to return. And it's interesting what you said about Viagra. It was initially produced as a heart medication to open up the blood vessels to the heart. And they came up with this wonderful name, Viagra. But then it turned out to have this sexual side effect, which is it's opening up blood vessels elsewhere in the body. That's all it's doing. So you can do that naturally.
Is it still prescribed as a heart medicine?
It's really, there are really other heart medicines that have come to the fore, and Viagra is now a blockbuster moneymaker for the market of folks who are having trouble with sexual performance.
Well, are there any particular foods that a man who's concerned with erectile dysfunction should be eating, and as well, ones he shouldn't be?
Wow, great question. The things that we really do want to focus on are all the things that, 30 years ago now, Dean Ornish and also Caldwell Esselstyn and others have shown us are good for the heart, because those are also going to be good for sexual performance. So you want to get all the cholesterol out of your diet, all the animal fat, and that allows the arteries to open up, and it happens really quickly. You know, a lot of guys will say, well, it took me decades to get into the kind of terrible shape that I'm in now to gain all this weight. But it doesn't take decades to get better, because even a very, very small opening or enlargement in the opening of an artery allows a dramatically increased flow through that artery. So I think of grains like rice and so forth as fine. Beans, of course, vegetables, fruits. Those are the foods really to emphasize. And I would be very careful about the fattier foods. There are natural fats in foods, and that's really all that you need. So those would be the foods to emphasize.
When you talk about this, I'm thinking about the human heart, both as this incredible pump in the center of our chests that can get blocked up if the cardiovascular system is impaired, And also, as the center, we talk about the heart as the center of our emotions and our even our spirits, our souls. And I find it telling that in opening up the physical heart, it also, the same foods that do that, or the same foods that block it on the other hand, have the same impact on a man's reproductive capacity. And it's as though we're being shown that we need to reconnect our hearts with our genitals if we're going to be empowered. And we need to take care of the health of both of them in the same way at the same time.
You know, John, it's neat that you put it that way, I have to say, because it reminds me of a situation we had here. We were doing a study in folks who had really bad neuropathy. This is more advanced diabetes. And for year after year after year, your body's being assaulted by not just cholesterol and high blood pressure and so forth, but this overly high blood sugar that's what diabetes is. In one of our studies, we had a man who was a musician, and he was quite overweight, and his diabetes was in bad control, and he had neuropathy, so his fingers weren't really working very well, and he also had erectile dysfunction. So everybody comes together, and every week we get in a discussion group, and we're swapping recipes and swapping challenges, and, you know, I'm going to be on the road next week, what should I eat? But also trading successes. And it's sort of what you were just describing, John, of this kind of openness and being open to change. After about just a couple of days, he started losing weight. And then as time went on, his blood sugars were getting better and better and better, and he didn't need so much medication. And he then discovered that his neuropathy was getting better, his fingers didn't hurt, and he was able to play his instrument, his musical instrument, much more effectively. And about 3 or 4 or 5 months into the study, he said, "I got something new, that my erectile dysfunction has gone away." And it was high fives all the way around. But the word openness that you just used really applies to both to how the group got along with each other, to what was happening in his body, and also being open to having an experience with health that you wouldn't otherwise have.
That's really, really beautiful. I think we can learn from our patients if we're listening to them. You, as a doctor, you're sometimes set up by cultural expectations to be the authority. And I know that you in many ways are, and you provide a lot of knowledge and guidance to your patients. Have you ever had a patient where you learned something from them, from their experience or their wisdom, that actually changed your lifestyle?
Oh, good heavens. I mean, I feel like we learn from our patients all the time. And a lot of what we have to learn is, well, first of all, learning humility is an important thing. What you said is right. You know, you graduate from medical school and you're supposed to have all the answers. But I have to say, sometimes the best thing that I do is just kind of be quiet and hear what my patients are concerned about, what they say works for them, and what might work for the next person, and also the challenges that they are struggling with. They also show us things that we didn't think were possible. In fact, speaking of this neuropathy trial, the whole reason I did it is in an earlier study where our whole goal was just to help patients who had diabetes to get better. I had a man who had had neuropathy for maybe 15, 20 years. I mean, his feet were really painful. And this is just diabetes attacking the nerves. And after 4 or 5 months on a plant-based diet, his neuropathy went away. And I was stunned because I didn't think this was going to happen. I didn't really think that a complication that advanced could actually completely remit. And I followed him for years after that and never came back. And so that taught me to maybe be a little bit more optimistic about what foods really can do. And then on the other hand, I've also talked to a lot of folks who say, you know, I love how I feel, but I really miss cheese, or I miss some other food. And that's caused me to want to understand what is it that's throwing that challenge to them, and how can I learn about that? And so, my best mentors really are the people that we work with in our studies and who come to see us in our clinic.
When you're talking about neuropathy and diabetes, I mean, your organization, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, has done some remarkable things. And I thought of you recently when the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics came out with their new and updated formal official position paper on plant-based diets. I know that Susan Levin, who works with you, was one of the co-authors. And what struck me was that from the evidence to date, the author said the risk of type 2 diabetes may be reduced by 62% with a plant-based diet. So what I want to ask you, Neil, is what is it about eating a plant-based or plant-strong diet that's so protective against so many diseases and so conducive to optimum health?
Well, part of it has to do with understanding what causes disease. And up until now, people have had quite a serious misconception about diabetes. The old idea was diabetes is too much, there's too much sugar in your blood, and that's true. And sugar comes from carbohydrate like bread or potatoes or rice, so that must have somehow caused the diabetes. And that's what's not true. At Yale University, a research team has been doing special scanning called MR spectroscopy on the muscles and the liver cells of people with type 2 diabetes. And what they find is that these cells, the muscle cells and the liver cells, get clogged up with fat that comes from the diet. And when this fat gets in the cells, it interferes with the cell's ability to pull the sugar out of the blood. So to make it short and sweet, you're sitting down to some fried chicken or some cheesy food, and the fat in those foods gets into the cells, and then the sugar can no longer get out of the blood into the cells. So the reason the sugar builds up, it's not that you're eating too much carbohydrate, it's that your cells are, for want of a better phrase, clogged with fat. And that also shows us the answer. So plant-based diet has no animal fat at all, and if you keep the oils rather low, the cells just dramatically change. And it also has no cholesterol and almost no saturated fat, so blood cholesterol levels fall, and that protects your heart and your brain. And the new, or relatively new, breakthrough is with Alzheimer's disease, that whatever is good for the heart also tends to be good for the brain. And I don't mean to suggest that a vegan diet or a plant-based diet is magic and that we'll never get sick, but it sure looks more and more like you're putting the right fuel in your tank. Your car doesn't want diesel. It wants unleaded, and your body doesn't want all the junk food and meat and cheese and so forth. It wants vegetables and fruits and beans and grains, and that's what allows it to really work.
Well, there are still many people who believe deeply in low-carb diets. They have been very popular over the years. It seems to be waves of them. Robert Atkins was the formulator of the famous Atkins low-carb diet, and that may be the most popular in history. When he died, there was a huge controversy, and you were right in the middle of it. Can you tell us what happened, why you did what you did, and what implications all this has for those of us who are wanting to make choices that are optimally healthful?
Sure. It starts with epidemiologic studies. People who live in areas where they eat a lot of carbohydrate, like rural Japan, rural China, where they eat huge amounts of rice or noodles, they have relatively little heart disease, very little cancer. And then when meat comes in through a westernization of the diet, their problems rise. And in complete contrast to that, Atkins and others said, no. Do you want to be healthy? You should be eating lots of meat and lots of gravy, but don't eat any carbohydrate. And the truth was that when people would cut out all of the carbohydrates, they would lose weight. And that's because carbohydrates are what people eat a lot of. So if you're just not eating any bread and any fruit and any starchy vegetables and you throw all that stuff out, your calorie content falls and you lose weight. But that's not a really healthy way to do it. And we started seeing research studies showing that about a third of low-carb dieters have this paradoxical effect. When you lose weight, your cholesterol ought to fall. But in these folks, their cholesterol was going way up. We said, well, that's because you're eating meat and heavy cream, and this is not a heart-healthy diet. And Atkins and his followers said, no, this is a perfectly healthy diet. This is good for your heart. And we felt they were being deceptive and really lying to the public. So when Robert Atkins died, and it was a tragic death, he slipped on a sidewalk and had a head injury. But when he died, a physician in the Midwest gave us a copy of his autopsy report that said that he had severe heart disease, or had a history of heart disease. And we thought, wait a minute, here's a guy who's been saying that this diet doesn't cause heart disease, and yet he had it himself and had tried to hush this up. And so we felt that if this report was getting around, that there's no reason to suppress it and hide it. And so we allowed that to be public. And you're right, it was controversial because people said, well, even if he was a dishonest person, we shouldn't be talking about what he died of or his health. And my feeling was that it was important for people to understand that this diet causes quite serious heart problems in some people. And I still think that today that it's very important for people to realize that a healthy diet is vegetables and fruits and grains and beans, and it's not steak and chicken and big hunks of salmon or any of that kind of stuff.
I know that in late last year, you gave a talk at the Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York, and what makes this remarkable to my eyes is that your talk was hosted by the Atkins Foundation with money that had been left by Dr. Robert Atkins himself.
I want to hand it to them. They said that they felt the time had come for my message not only to be heard by people everywhere else, but by their own people. And they couldn't have been nicer. And we had a very, very good discussion, and we presented our research, and they were quite enthusiastic about it.
Well, I find that remarkable. That feels like a breakthrough, a bridge being built where before there had just been a schism.
Well, things have moved along. It's, you know, we didn't have the research that we had before, and now I think we have a very good handle on what diets do, what a low-carb diet does and what it doesn't do, what its risks may be, and also what a plant-based diet does. We have a lot of research on that. We have done much of it here, but there have been many other independent centers that have done good work, and it's really clear to me that a plant-based diet is the healthiest way to go. And despite the fact that this is not in any way how I was raised as a kid in Fargo, North Dakota, it wasn't the way that you were raised. We learn about it and we embrace the power of food.
Well, when you talk about recent research, I'm thinking about there have been a lot of extensive studies done on done with the people who are Seventh-day Adventists. And these are people who most of them don't smoke. They don't drink very, very much alcohol, if at all. They're quite health conscious, and while they are supposed to be by the tenets of their religion, vegetarians, some of them are and some of them aren't. So researchers have studied these people and found some fascinating correlations between the diets they eat, their weights, and their health outcomes. What have we learned specifically from the Adventist health studies?
Well, they showed us several important things. First of all, the more you get the animal products out of your diet, the slimmer people tend to be, which is to say that, say, an Adventist who's health conscious, not smoking, but he is a regular meat and dairy user, is going to have an average BMI, body mass index, of about 28.8, whereas a healthy BMI, the upper limit is 25. So they're overweight. Then if they go to a semi-vegetarian diet, which is meat less than once a week, or a pesco vegetarian diet, no meat at all except for fish, or a vegetarian diet that might have dairy in it, if they make these stepwise changes, their average body mass index goes down and down and down until they hit vegan. And the vegan group among the Adventists is the only group where their body mass index is on average quite squarely in the middle of the healthy range. And it's the difference between, say, an ovo-lacto vegetarian and a vegan is about 15 pounds or thereabouts. So just getting that cheese out of the diet makes a big difference. The other thing is that diabetes follows the same gradient. It's quite prevalent in meat eaters and quite uncommon in the vegans.
So do these lower BMIs, lower body mass index numbers, correlate to better health outcomes?
Oh, yes, yes. Diabetes, we mentioned the risk of diabetes is, probably 2/3 less frequent among the vegans compared to others. Your heart health is better, reduced risk of certain cancers, greater longevity, everything is better. You're not going to live forever, but a plant-based diet is going to help you.
I want to shift our topic a little bit. For many people, the taste of sugar on their tongues triggers the release of opiates in their brains. And this, in turn, triggers the release of dopamine, which creates a lot of good feelings. We know that just about every drug of abuse, be it cocaine or alcohol or heroin or even tobacco, in one mechanism or another increases dopamine activity. Does this mean, then, that drugs and the highly sweetened foods we've come to associate with celebration actually hijack the brain's dopamine system?
It really is true. In the same way that drugs or alcohol can, they become habit forming because they trigger the release of dopamine in the brain. Dopamine is the feel-good chemical, the reward chemical. Junk food can do the same thing. And particularly when people overeat junk food, they get this little extra dopamine. And that can be disastrous. So in our research, we have been looking for how do you get dopamine in a natural way? And there really are three sources that are important. The first is social support. When you're with friends, loved ones, you get just a little more dopamine activity than you would otherwise. And the more intimate those encounters are, the more dopamine you get. That's why support groups are effective. The second one, by the way, is physical activity. So when you see people in an aerobic class and they're sweating and they're feeling good, those are people who don't want to instantly sit down and have a bowl of ice cream. You know, they're feeling good about themselves, and they get the combination of the social support and the physical activity. And the third one, interestingly enough, is music. There have been some really fascinating studies from McGill University using brain scanning technology where when you play music to individuals, they get dopamine released in the brain, whether it's happy music or sad music, as long as it is appealing music. And the reason I like that is that Beethoven has no calories and no sodium and no cholesterol. And so the point that I'm making is not that physical activity or music or intimacy is going to totally replace junk food. But if you do this comparison, let's say you have a person who's completely alone, sedentary, their life is devoid of beauty. That is a person set up to try to find solace in junk food. On the other hand, if you've got a person who's got friendships and they're exercising and they have beauty in their life, that's a person who has at least a measure of protection. And I've taken this a step further, and I work with actually a number of wonderful professional musicians. And we just put out a new record of music that I have to say gives me plenty of dopamine, and I hope that your listeners will check it out. Our group is called Carbon Works, as in we are all carbon, these are our works. And we have music that I am going to say is going to perhaps rival the effect of junk food on the human psyche.
Well, without the calories. I look forward to hearing it, and I'm sure our listeners do too. You said that you discovered a gene that in your work with, so I guess it's your diabetic patients, who that seem to make people more susceptible to addictions, including food addictions.
That's right. What they actually have is inside the brain, they have too few dopamine receptors, and the neurotransmitter dopamine leaves one cell, it arrives in another, and it's gone very, very rapidly. And if you don't have very many dopamine receptors, you don't get much effect of it because the dopamine is gone before it can attach. So what that means is that these people go through life searching for dopamine sources, and that's where the junk food comes in, or smoking or drug use. So we found it in half of people with type 2 diabetes. That's extraordinary. So let's say you're born with a genetic vulnerability to getting diabetes, and you are also born with a genetic tendency to have too little dopamine. You are likely to overeat, and then as you overeat, then the diabetes risk comes in, and that's a really dangerous combination.
Is the gene that you're talking about that gives you fewer dopamine receptors or an impaired ability to absorb dopamine, is that the A1 allele of the DRD2 gene?
That's right. Yeah, DRD2, dopamine receptor D2. And the A1 allele is the one that means you'll have about one-third fewer dopamine receptors compared to somebody else. And if you look at families, there are some families where mom's got it, dad's got it, and so all the kids got it from both parents. And it will manifest differently. For one kid, it's alcoholism. For another kid, it's overeating. For another kid, it's drug abuse. And for some, it's all of those things put together. And then you look at another family where they don't have that. They don't have that allele at all. And you might occasionally see a person who's overeating or who's got alcohol issues, but but not like the families that have this dopamine issue. And this wouldn't matter if it were rare, but it's super common. And it also wouldn't matter if, as was the case hundreds of years ago, food was expensive and you couldn't overeat. There wasn't fast food. There weren't candy machines everywhere. And so you might have an addictive personality, but there's nothing to get addicted to. Now the culture allows you to fully manifest any addictive behavior you might have.
It seems like for those who have an addictive personality, who have a genetic reality that makes it harder for them to experience the rewards of dopamine in their brains, it would be even more important, it would be most important for those people to find healthful ways to activate the dopamine in their brains.
That's why when people come in here for a research study, we never, ever just hand them a piece of paper or a book. You know, here's the diet, come back in 3 months. Never. We always say, okay, part of this is you need sort of an external structure, a skeleton around to help you to stay on the straight and narrow. And that's a once a week group. And they come in every week. They don't know anybody. They're scared at first, but they start bonding. And that group keeps them afloat. Even if they just have to show up. And when we go down from, say, once a week to once every 2 weeks, you start to see the support is not enough anymore. And you go down to once a month, and some of these people really aren't getting the support they need. Now, there are plenty of people where they'll say, hey, this is not hard. You go vegan, I'm fine, no issues. But for most people, they do need some support, at least at the beginning. And for those people who are really vulnerable, I just say you've really got to do it. By the way, can I mention one other thing, John? We tend to think of addictive personalities, but let's face it, food manufacturers are so creative. You can have had a really good upbringing and no dopamine issues at all. They will find a way to addict you if they can. It is not you. It's not a moral failing if you're feeling food addicted. The problem is the food. And we should remember that, because in the same way as you can get trapped at work, you can get trapped in traffic, you can get trapped by addictive food. It is not a moral failing. It's nothing to be ashamed of, but it's every reason to try to break free.
I remember learning that the processed food industry, the members of what's called the Grocery Manufacturers Association, these are the big food giants that make most of the packaged foods, processed foods that we find on our supermarket shelves, hire people that they call, this is their term, craveability experts, whose job it is, and these are scientists, to enhance the addictive properties of the foods they sell to us.
They do that, and you can demonstrate this on day one of a child's life. You can take a brand newborn baby, and you can mix a little sugar into sugar water and dribble it into the baby's mouth, and that will cause the release of opiates in the child's brain at that age. And I really want to emphasize, this is not a moral defect. This is the way the human body works, because your brain is designed to detect subtle sweet tastes like fruit and to be attracted to them. And if you have concentrated sucrose in a solution like soda, you're overdriving that mechanism and you're getting the person hooked. And we see it with cheese. I've seen so many people say, my thing is cheese. And they kind of laugh about it and say, I don't know why cheese. I have to tell you, John, I actually wrote a whole book about this that came out a little bit earlier this year. It's called The Cheese Trap, because I've seen so many people have trouble losing weight, or they have asthma, or migraines, or arthritis, or other health conditions. And they're not realizing that the dairy fat, the dairy protein, other things are triggering these problems, and they're not sure what to substitute for it. So anyway, the point being, yes, there are industries that know that they know these foods are capable of getting people hooked, and yet we can find ways to break free.
Well, you're talking about cheese. The evidence in recent years against dairy products has been growing. There was a recent meta-analysis published in Nutrition Journal. It reviewed 11 studies encompassing more than 700,000 men and women. And the goal was to assess the relationship between the consumption of dairy products, including cheese, and cancer mortality rates. And what they found was that men who consumed the most whole milk increased their risk of death from prostate cancer by as much as 50% compared with those who consumed the least. And women raised their rates of their hormone-related cancers by comparable amounts. It's clear that dairy products, including cheese, considerably increase the risk of dying from cancer. But what about soy milk and almond milk and all the other non-dairy milks we see now? Are they an improvement or do they carry their own risks?
They're a dramatic improvement. And they do not appear to carry a cancer risk in particular. And that's an important point because you hear this sort of mythology fairly frequently. People will say soy must have estrogens in it, and so it could cause breast cancer, or a woman with breast cancer would have her cancer advance if she eats soy. And so researchers have looked into this question, and there have been about 45 studies on soy and the risk of developing breast cancer, and it turns out to be exactly the opposite of what the mythology had said. Women who consume the most, say, soy milk or tofu, have at least a 30% reduction in their risk of developing breast cancer compared to women who avoid soy. In other words, soy reduces cancer risk. And then we have studies including about 10,000 women who had had breast cancer in the past. And those who consume the most soy had about a 30% reduction in their risk of the cancer coming back. So soy turned out to be protective. You don't have to have soy. You know, a plant-based diet isn't the soy cheerleading club. But it looks like soy products, soy milk, tofu, tempeh, simple soy products, reduce the risk of developing cancer, and for women who have had cancer, they reduce the risk of dying of it.
Well, speaking about women and cancer, there is a paradox in nutrition, or at least it appears to be one to me, something I haven't been able to kind of parse out, and I wonder if you could help. There have been numerous studies that have shown that dairy products increase the risk for ovarian cancer in women. But some studies, and sometimes these very same studies, have shown that women who consume the most calcium from food have the lowest risk for ovarian cancer. So I see a kind of a paradox here. What are we to make of these findings?
I think we need to stay tuned and because the research in this area is still fairly new, but probably the biggest suspect is the sugars. The sugar in milk, as you know, is lactose, and it's made of two smaller sugars hooked together. So when you drink milk and those sugars break apart, assuming you can digest lactose, or in yogurt, they're already broken apart by the bacteria that are in there. And when the lactose breaks apart, it releases glucose and galactose. Those are the smaller sugars. And that's what people think is going on. The galactose might be toxic to the ovary. At least that's one of the hypotheses that people are operating on. So, yeah, there's fat in dairy products and there's protein in dairy products that have health consequences of their own. But the sugar may be more of a problem than just the gassiness and bloating that a lot of people get from dairy. It might actually be toxic in this other way.
So this would be, I think, another reason to get your calcium from kale and collards and other green leafy vegetables and other plants, instead of getting it from dairy products.
Yeah, and there are a lot of surprises. Let me mention two more real quick. I was writing an article about dairy, and I was mentioning sources of sodium, and I said the cheese is very, very high in sodium, and the editor wrote back and said, no, that can't be true. I mean, when we think of high sodium foods, we're talking about potato chips and stuff, right? Let me give you the numbers. 2 ounces of potato chips have 330 milligrams of sodium. If it's cheddar, it's 350. If it's Velveeta, it's over 800 milligrams of sodium in 2 ounces. So massive. The other thing that people tend to not think about, I know there some of your listeners are appropriately sensitive to animals, and they get away from consuming animal products for that reason. And there's an interesting fact that a lot of people may not be aware of, and that is that a cow is not going to give milk until the cow has been impregnated. And so dairy cows are impregnated every year, and they are not volunteering for this. It's artificial insemination that they don't have any choice about. And so then they give birth 9 months later. And if the calf is male, the calf becomes veal fairly quickly. And if the calf is female, she is going to become part of the dairy herd, but she can't stay with her mother, because if she does, she's going to take the milk that the dairy farmers want to sell. So there's this terribly sad thing that happens to every dairy cow every single year, is after they're impregnated and then they give birth, their calf is taken away and stuck by herself or himself in a little hutch. And it's about the cruelest thing you can do to a baby is to take away his mother or her mother. And the cruelest thing you can do to an animal is to take away all her offspring and then just extract her milk like she's a machine. And they go through this every single year. And by around the age of four, the farmers have discovered that if you kill her and use her daughters instead, you get more milk per unit feed. So dairy cows don't live a normal life. They are impregnated and milked, and their offspring are taken away. And when they're about four, they are sold off to slaughter, hung up by the foot, their throats are slit, and their daughters are then put in their place for the next 4 years, and then the same thing will happen to them. And I'm a doctor, I am not an ethicist, but I have to say that it's a pretty creepy industry when you look at what happens. And so people who don't want to consume meat because they kill the animals, when they look at what happens in dairy, they kill all of them too. They just do it more slowly. So I raise that not to frighten people, but I raise it because I'm talking to a 16-year-old guy. He's not worried about his prostate, but he's got a heart for animals. And if that causes him to change his diet, then our arteries don't care why we make the change.
It's fascinating that the food choices that cause the least suffering to animals cause the least suffering to our bodies. They open our hearts, both our spiritual heart, our emotional heart, in the sense of our ability to connect empathically with other animals and other people and ourselves, and also our physical heart, our arterial system, our cardiovascular system. And in that way, I think we're being shown something of great significance to our empowerment and our liberation and our joy as humans.
Well, without getting overly spiritual about it, John, I have to admit that when I was a kid growing up in North Dakota, I hunted. And my father had four boys, and he would take us out, and we would hunt. And around the time that I hit my early teen years, I traded my gun for a guitar. And I started playing music and working with others. And there is no better way to kind of release joy in your life and open yourself up than playing music. And I mentioned this earlier, that we didn't have a clue at that time that what's going on in the brain is that it's releasing dopamine, and you're with other people and you're physically active and you're making this beautiful, hopefully beautiful music. And I look back at when I was looking down my sights at animals and blowing them away and the prairies of North Dakota, thinking, gee, I kind of wish I'd made that trade a little bit earlier.
I'm thinking of the human hand, this marvelous instrument, exquisite in its capabilities. It can be used. We can use our fingers to pull triggers and kill. We can use our fingers to plant seeds. We can use our fingers to play the guitar. We can use our fingers to heal each other and provides comfort and care to one another. There's something about our food choices that gives us an opportunity to choose who we want to be, who we're going to become, what we're going to be loyal to, what values we're going to uphold by the way we live and the statements we make with how we're living. There's something about ethics to me that is really important to our physiology. It's being a whole human being, a mind, body, and spirit linked, integrated as a unity. Modern medicine doesn't tend to notice that. I mean, we treat symptoms as inconveniences to be masked. We don't think of the body, mind, spirit, or the body, mind, heart in any way, really, in medicine as a unifying reality. But it is, I think.
Well, there's really no question about it in my mind. And when we deal with patients, we not only have to give them a good diagnosis and appropriate treatment, but you also have to treat them with respect and inquire about their families, not just because, you know, you want to relate to them, but also the family members are at risk for the same problems that they have. So it's critically important to be open with this. And to allow yourself to be open to thought.
There's one more topic I want to ask you about. We touched on it briefly earlier. When we talk about a human being, who we're talking about their health. We're talking about their physical health, their mental health, their emotional health, all these things at once, really. You're the author of a very, very fine book, Power Foods for the Brain. And I want to talk with you a little bit about Alzheimer's disease. It seems to take a toll on a person, obviously on their memory and on their cognitive capacity, eventually on their life. That's unique. It does something to, and it does something to the family as well, who have become caregivers for someone who may not even eventually recognize who they are. Studies have shown that there are certain foods that are beneficial to the brain and that can help prevent Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. If you were going to design an Alzheimer's prevention diet, what would it be?
Yeah, well, a number of teams have been looking at exactly this, and they are starting to test it. In Chicago, a study called the Chicago Health and Aging Project got started back in 1993, and they showed that saturated fat, that what's in bacon and cheese and so forth, it's not just bad for your heart, it also greatly increases the risk of Alzheimer's. Trans fats in donuts do the same thing. There are protective foods like foods rich in vitamin E, so that's the nuts and the seeds. They're protective, and a number of others. And that's the whole reason that I wrote Power Foods for the Brain. So if I were going to design a diet to prevent it, I would get away from animal fat completely. Dairy products, surprisingly, are the number one source of saturated fat. So they're going to be the first to go, and meats are going to go too, and eggs. But I would also keep oils fairly low. And that doesn't mean that the natural oils that are in seeds or nuts or even, there are even traces of oils in vegetables. That's okay, and you need that. But when we extract huge amounts of oils and fry things in them and dribble them all over our pasta, that's really more oil than the body should be having. And I would eat for color. You know, the human retina is an amazing thing. The human retina can recognize beta carotene at 100 yards. It's orange. And it can recognize lycopene at the same distance. That's red in a tomato. And anthocyanins, that's the deep purple color of, say, blueberries or grapes. The retina evolved to detect these antioxidants, and the brain paints them as attractive. Nobody ever thought, oh, those carrots are ugly. We think, you know, it's a pretty color. But a cat or a dog is a natural carnivore, and they don't have your color vision, and they're more interested in movement. And, of course, we take those same colors now and we put them in M&M's bags and things like that. But those colors are supposed to be attracting us to eat the antioxidant-rich foods. And so that's something else to emphasize. Eat plant-based, but eat for color.
Eat for color. So I'm thinking about when you mentioned blueberries and they're rich in anthocyanins. I've seen studies that show that blueberries improve learning and recall. I've seen studies that show blueberries are helpful in preventing dementia. And I want to ask you, is it blueberries in particular, or are all berries, which are colorful in their own ways, helpful in preserving cognitive function?
I'm guessing it's the whole range of anthocyanins, not just blueberries. At University of Cincinnati, they did tests on blueberries. They also did tests on grapes. And about two cups of grape juice over a three-month period increased recall and increased memory. So I'm guessing it's the whole range of anthocyanins.
Well, Neil, I want to add here something to you, to our listeners. One of the campaigns that your organization, PCRM, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, has undertaken is to improve hospital food. And I want to acknowledge some of your successes, and I want our listeners to know about them. Last year, Norton Children's Hospital in Louisville, Kentucky, closed its McDonald's restaurant, and that was the fourth major hospital to ban Big Macs in the year. Your campaign has been successful. You're working with hospitals around the country, not just to get Big Macs and McDonald's and other junk food out, which they should be, but you're also improving the food served in hospital cafeterias and on patient trays. And the food, this is really important, I think, because the food that hospitals serve carries the stamp of approval of Western medicine. It sends a message to the patient that this is the food that this immensely powerful institution wants you to eat for your health and healing. So by banning Big Macs and instead offering healthful plant-based options, And by serving some of the many plant-based comfort foods that appeal to patients and to the visitors and to staff, and by offering healthful choices, truly healthful choices, veggie chili and southern greens and fruit smoothies, the hospitals that you're reaching are setting patients on the right path. They're helping to bring down rates of obesity and heart disease and diabetes and dementia. It's just a remarkable thing. And Neil, I want to acknowledge the importance of this work you're doing, and I want to thank you for it.
Well, thanks for saying that, John. I want to tip my hat to the American College of Cardiology. We've been working with them, and they asked a very logical question, which is, if you wake up from bypass surgery, why should you be fed bacon and eggs? And I'm happy to work with the American College of Cardiology on this, and they have prepared a really interesting set of guidelines, which says every hospital ought to be having plant-based foods available for patients, for visitors, and also for their own staff. And that's a terrific thing. And the processed meats like bacon and sausage and ham really ought to be gone. And that's, I think, a huge step in the right direction. And for anybody who's listening to this program, if you're affiliated with a hospital or working with a hospital, we would be more than happy to make these guidelines available to you and to give you a toolkit that will allow you to talk to your own hospital staff about how they can really take great pride in the healthful foods that they offer.
Well, thank you. You know, Neil, it's always a joy to talk with you. I find, first of all, I consider you a friend and a colleague and an ally in so many ways. And I admire and respect your work and your person, the way you come across, the even, balanced, calm wisdom that you convey. It's really reassuring. Some of these changes that people are being asked to make, some of the health scares that they might be experiencing are frightening and can bring up a lot of anxiety. And there's something about the way you are, your bedside manner, they used to call it, just your quality of your presence that is reassuring and heartening and uplifting. And I thank you.
Well, thank you for saying that, John. And right back at you, you have been really guiding the way in such an effective way, and Ocean right there with you doing that for over so many years. And it's been great to work with you. And we want to, on the one hand, be as impatient as possible because there's a lot of work that needs to be done to protect this planet and all the people who are in it. And yet at the same time, I think we also have to realize that some of the things are new and challenging to people. We want to take people where they are and help them to make the next step in the best way that they possibly can. So thank you for including me in this program. It's been terrific to talk with you again, John.
Absolutely. One step at a time. We're changing lives and we're changing the world together. We've been talking here with Dr. Neil Barnard, founder and president of Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, founder of the Barnard Medical Center, and best-selling author of 17 books, including his latest, The Cheese Trap. Neil, you've spent decades studying the relationship between food and health, and your work is helping shift the course of how medicine is practiced, and it's also helping to empower individuals all over the planet. We want to thank you for your decades of impeccable research, for sharing your critical insights with such clarity, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Great. Well, thank you, Ocean. Thank you, John.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and you want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then check this out. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus ebooks, courses, trainings, recipes, and videos. And this empowerment package is available for a huge 50% discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.